Okay, thank you very much, Alain, for the organization of this very nice symposium, and to Ariel and to all the people around to take care of us. So, the title is Perineuronal Net and Long-Term Memory. Well, long-term memory really is not the typic. It's not the stuff about perineuronal net. I will say, like it was said by Roger Tien, that really perineuronal net is really involved in long-term memory, but we don't know really how at the present time. So what I wish to start now with what we did many years ago, and we are using this single cell RT-PCR since 1989 now. And it's a good day today to make a tribute to Bertrand Lambolez, which is on the second row over there. He was young at that time, it was in 89. Well, it was already in his third, fourth year of his PhD. And he came back one day from the SFN meeting, the one of 89, and he told me, Jean, it's impossible. We have here an embarrassing number of subunits of ionotropic receptors, splice variant, addition, and that was for the glutamate, the GABA, the nicotinic receptors. And so the people will never be able to understand how these various subunits are forming eventually a single receptor, a single channels. And that was really the question was, how many subunits in one channel? What was the combination of the different subunits in a single channel? And we developed a technique for that, which is single cell RT-PCR after patch clamp. So you simply use your pipette that you use to get electrophysiology, and then you will aspirate the cell. At the same time, you put some histochemical marker, a biocetin, for example, and so you get in your slides a very nice cell body. Here it's a bipolar cell. And then you do the RT and the amplification by PCR, and then you can get the composition of your cell, and we went up to 50 different type of mRNA species. I may say now, everybody will say, well, of course, we all do that. And the future at the present time is RT-RNA-seq, started at the Allen Institute by Tazik, a very nice paper last year in January, but also from Fuzik, Linarsson, Arcani, Caldwell, Tolias, and so on. So everybody is doing that. And if you do any search about this technique, you will find 22,000 papers about RT-PCR or single-cell genomics. That was the first paper we published. And I may say, it was tough. We sent the paper three times, and it came back. And I may say, of course, in 89, if you were going to a real lab of molecular biology, we were not molecular biologists, we were scientists trying to make a sense of the brain. And the idea that you could go in a single cell, aspirate the innards of the cell, and transform that to get the mRNA and then amplify to the cDNA. Well, you can say that over beers at night at the SFN meeting, but if you are a sense person at that time, if you are a real molecular biologist, you said, okay, let's go. Well, it's not possible. It's impossible to do that without genomic contamination, without degradation of your mRNA. Forget it. So, as I was not a molecular biologist, and I was very keen with the people with me, I may say, I said, let's do it. And so we did it, and it worked. But eventually, after third round of referee at Neuron, the referee, the last referee, said, "The authors have performed, I will show you that, have performed all the controls asked for. I accept their paper, although I am still convinced that performing single-cell RT-PCR is impossible." Well, of course, 30 years later, we have 22 publications in PubMed, 3 million of page in Google. Well, I may say that some important person have much more than 3 million of pages in Facebook, but that's not the goal. So now, when this technique is applied to not only for receptor, but to analyze the content of single cell, you have this very nice paper from the Allen Institute, where they look by RNA-seq at all the genes they could amplify with their RNA-seq, and they came with a nice taxonomy of their adult mouse cortical cell with 23 classes of interneurons, 19 of pyramidal, and 7 of glia. If now you start again the work, I may say at the present time at the Allen, they think that maybe you will get 100 classes of interneurons, and as many for the pyramids and the glia. So the diversity is enormous. Is this diversity really real, I will say? That's a question, you know. I will not enter too much in that. But look at the cell that we are looking for. That was the parvalbumin cell and the somatostatin cell. And you have 6 of the somatostatin cell cluster and 7 for the parvalbumin. The classification of the parvalbumin with the upper layer and the lower layer of the cortex, all that is still in the process of going on. It's not perfect. Although other people are doing also that, people in, I will mention Linnarsson and Fuzik and so on. So the technique, you know, in the last year, you get several papers and several meetings on that, and another one, for example, at the end of June in the Institut ICM, the Institut du Cerveau et de la Moelle. So it's a technique which is very useful. And why? First, we can define classes of cell and classes of interneurons over here. And what we know was already is that really it should be polycystic. It's not only one single marker. At the beginning of my career in neuroscience, what we were looking, it was a single marker for a population of a cell. That's not existing anymore. The characterization of a single cell will be polytetic and relies on anatomy, electrophysiology, molecular biology, the embryonic origin. And I wish to say something about the importance of gene expression versus electrophysiology. I think really to characterize a cell is much better to look at the gene expression than the electrophysiology. I will show you that on the next slide. This next slide, you know, is Cajal, or Gaul, or God. Cajal was really the first one to do something interesting in the brain. And still today, that picture, you know, has been shown in so many places. So I just want to show that in these interneurons, I like this quote. He said that the neurons are the butterflies of the soul. The beating of those wings may someday, who knows, clarify the secret of mental life. Well, it will take many centuries, I suppose, that before we know the secret of mental life, but why not to expect that? Anyway, so I wish to show you that we have here 2 cells, the 2 cell A. And they are bipolar neurons containing VIP, and they are adapting. But this one you see is irregular spiking. And on our first classification, you said, well, you know, we have irregular spiking neurons, and we have an adapting neurons, and eventually, the irregular spiking neurons, they are adapting. They are simply a current, a potassium current, and if you block this current, then you pass from irregular spiking to adapting. So then when you start a big classification using criteria, electrophysiological criteria, you could be in trouble. So what we did in the recent year was to analyze the expression with many different markers. You see here we have a 26 marker. And we look at the interneurons. And we had the electrophysiology of the interneurons, but I told you we are not so much looking at the electrophysiology. We believe much more in the importance of the genetic marker, the expression marker. And then you see, well, you have some cell I will not describe anymore, but the VIP cell, you have the somatostatin cell containing somatostatin, of course, and then you have the FS, the fast spiking, around 50% was said this morning. Yes, it is true. So we are here in the somatosensory cortex, and you see that using all these markers, we are able to get two clusters. The PVMP, MP means metallopeptidase, and the PV somatostatin. Yes, you have a colocalization of parvalbumin with somatostatin. What is interesting is that when you look at the marker, the metallopeptidase, ADAM15, ADAM-TS15, ADAM-TS8, and MME, which is neprilysin, the enzyme important for Alzheimer's. It is not true, but it is, as you will see, but MME, neprilysin, was proposed to be the treatment to get rid of the beta peptide of Alzheimer. Anyway, so in this pale blue, you see that we have some peptidases which are there, and none of these peptidases are expressed in the PV somatostatin neuron. So we have really two classes of interneurons there. One class co-express parvalbumin with the three metallopeptidases we look for, ADAM-TS8, ADAM-TS15, and MME, and another one co-express with somatostatin. And so they are fast spiking neurons. You will see that later on. ADAM-TS, well, the problem with ADAM-TS is that when you make knockout, then it's lethal. But okay, it's known by all the people working in matrix biology, the surgeon and working on joints and bones, that enzyme is well known. ADAM-TS means, this is the acronym of disintegrin and metalloproteinase with thrombospondin motif. And you may get also some ADAM-TS without the activity. And this ADAM-TS L5, like 5, for example, seems to be associated in some study, genetic study, about the presence of that mutant in schizophrenia, for example. Well, you find a lot of gene in schizophrenia, that's for sure. The interesting stuff also today for what Carinali told us is that all these enzymes are in proteolytic cascade. Proteolytic cascade like complement fixation formation, like fibrinogen formation, like the incoagulation, like fibrinolysis, and so on. So in the formation of peptides. So that you don't have a single proteolytic enzyme is always associated with others which are activating some of the enzyme. So, neprilysin, that enzyme I met in my life at least once because it was known at one time as the onkephalinase. It was destroying the onkephalin. But as as I mentioned, it degrades a number of secreted peptides, including amyloid beta peptide plaque in Alzheimer's disease. And people try to produce a lot in situ or even injecting in blood this enzyme to cure Alzheimer. Don't do it, it's not effective. So, peptidase. I told you about peptidase and the importance of peptidase. And when we did the work with the Allen Institute with in situ hybridization, on the 24,000 genes of the genome, the entire genome of the mice, they found that 1,000 was expressed in the cerebral cortex. And when you look at the subpopulation of interneurons, 120 of these 24,000 genes were expressed in the interneurons. Now look at the peptidase. Well, you know, quite close to 3% of the entire genome are peptidase. And in the cerebral cortex, you have all this series of peptidase, ADAM 33, 15, 8, and so on. And in the interneurons, only these four, ADAM TS 15, ADAM TS 8, neprilysin, and relin. So, when we did some double fish localization with parvalbumin ADAM TS, you see that they colocalize, and they colocalize parvalbumin with MME. So, the expression of the gene is in cell with parvalbumin is associated with MME and ADAM TS. And when you look at the other population, somatostatin, large population in the cortex, you don't have at all this overlap. So we have really the two populations, parvalbumin with the metallopeptidase and the parvalbumin or the SST alone with SST or the SST alone with no colocalization with protease. Then, you know, Wisteria floribunda. Some of the people who came in my home last night, two nights ago, they have seen that we have that on the facade of the house. So it's very nice, Wisteria floribunda. And the good thing is that you get a lectin, and that lectin label the PNN, as you know. And that's a very nice picture from Lenzjo, which is working in the lab of Marianne Finn and Torkel Hastings in Oslo. And you see what you wish to see, more or less. That's always difficult with anatomy, is that you produce. You see really that the perineuronal net is surrounding, which look like projection, like the synapse we have seen just a few hours ago, the nice picture done by Takao. Takao, you, it's for you I'm speaking. So, and yes, you may imagine that you have all the projection going there, and the PNN around it will block, and when it is done, it is locked like a grid. The change of the synapse will not be possible. That's an hypothesis, of course. Now, to show that really we have the colocalization now of the enzyme ADAM TS with the parvalbumin, with the Wisteria floribunda, then you see, for example, over here that we have 1, 2, 3 cells which are the colocalization of the red, the green, and the blue. So we really have some cells which contain the three. They express the CSG, CPSG. They express parvalbumin and the enzyme ADAM TS. So that's nice picture again. And you see that there are basket cells too there, the projection from the parvalbumin unbasketed, and some of the basket cells contain ADAM TS. the peptidase. So it's not restricted to parvalbumin, and we'll say that several times later on. So now, again, the story about the parvalbumin and the somatostatin. When you get somatostatin, you don't get any PNN, but you get PNN with parvalbumin and the NWFA. You see that. So really, the SST is never associated, at least as far as I knew at the present time, was never associated with WFA. But maybe someone has seen it, and I will accept it. So we published that in 2 years ago, and we were working on the somatosensory cortex of the mouse. So I was quite afraid that all that was not true for the other area of the brain. And so I went to the Allen Institute, and we did some heat map with the expression of parvalbumin. So it's a heat map, so it is red, you have a lot. It is white, you have less. And you see that the ACAN, AGRECAN, and ADAMTS, they co-localize in some of the PV neurons. And when you have SST, expression of SST, you never have ACAN or ADAMTS, AGRECAN. So they exclude, really. So now I come back with the cluster over here. You don't see in that cluster, it's no class labeled parvalbumin with SST. I suppose that in the new classification, maybe it could come. You know, at the present time at the Allen Institute, they had, for that work, they had 1,600 cells. Now they have 12,000 cells. So then I suppose the classification will be more interesting. And also the sensitivity increased very much. For a long time, they could not get, and for example, the enzyme making PNN, the enzyme of Kitagawa and other people, never see any cell expressing that enzyme. So I suppose the enzyme exists. But at the present time, we did not see it. So, the structure of the perineuronal net. Well, it's quite complex, as you know. And it contains so many stuff. And it's very difficult to understand how it is made. And you have very good scientists who work on that since many years. And it's still, well, that's a nice representation. AGRECAN, NEUROCAN, BREVICAN, VERSICAN, the linking protein, the HPLN1, HPLN4. It's a little complicated, all this stuff, because the name of the genes are changing from time to time. So, but if you keep a good look at the Jackson gene expression, then you can follow. Enfin, even I was able to follow. And then you see tenascin, tenascin C, tenascin R, and then some phosphatase, and so on. So it's complicated. And how it is made now? What I could tell you is that it's made, I really don't know how. When you look at the parvalbumin, well, the cells are surrounded by PNN. So you should expect to see all the components of the PNN there. It's true, you see, as I showed you previously, AGRECAN is there. ADAMTS is not there, but ADAMTS 8, yes. ADAMTS 15, yes, but then you have expression in other cells. BCAN, yes, but it is expressed in other cells too. And if you go there, you see in glial cell, a lot of BCAN, BREVICAN in glial cell. HPLN1, yes, it is there, but it's much more concentrated or expressed in interference gamma, gamma TP, what's that? It's interferon gamma induced GTPase. Well, yeah. And then HPNL4 is expressed everywhere, maybe a little more in the parvalbumin cell. MME, it's okay. And CAN everywhere. The TPA, it's not a lot. PTRZ that you have seen on the previous slide, yes. Somatostatin, of course not. And VCAN. And VCAN, what you can see, VCAN is in glial cell too. And in this SMAD cell. So the conclusion of that is that to get PNN surrounding the parvalbumin, you have the cooperativity of many different cells. So we are not yet there. The complication is also with OTX. OTX is there, but it's coming, as you know, from the plexus, and is part of the complex. You have semaphorin, which was shown by James. And so, complex structure. So, at the present time, as I told you, I don't know where are the enzymes. Maybe we should do single cell RT-PCR, not the RT RNA-seq, to see that. But it's a difficult stuff. And the most difficult story also is that really the structure at the nano level is not done yet, except we have seen this nice work on STORM by the people in Harvard, and that's really a beginning. But really what's needed is really to have the structure of this perineuronal net. The function now. The function, the first thing you read in the paper of Brooker, Artic, and so on, well, perineuronal net is quite charged with the sulfonate, so it should change the permeability to ions. And still say, for example, Balmer, and we have seen some interesting results from Alexander, showing that really, well, if you get out of the of the perineuronal net with chondroitinase, you change some of the electrical property of the cell, the parvalbumin cell. Let's go back to my two classes. They are fast-spiking neurons, both of them, one containing metallopeptidase and surrounded by the perineuronal net, and this PV cell containing somatostatin. They are not surrounded by perineuronal net. When you look at the property, the electrophysical property of this cell, you see that, well, of course, the PVSST, they have a higher input resistance, and the parvalbumin with metallopeptidase, they fire a little higher than the one of with SST. But really, in a natural system where we have two PV cells, one containing metallopeptidase and surrounded by PNN, and the other one with SST, which are not, then you don't see a big difference. So I don't think that the PNN is important, really, for the natural properties of these parvalbumin neurons. So what's the function, so? It regulates cell migration, could be, yes. And for myself, really, I believe that in the synapse formation and the regulation of synaptic plasticity could be very important because as you know, on the synapse, all the receptors move and they could go to a non-synaptic area. I suppose that really the function of the PNN is to rigidify the synaptic system. And no one of the subunits will move to the other part. So really, it makes the neuron fixed for the rest of his life, I don't know. if you follow what was telling by Roger Stien, I think his title was wrong first, but very long-term memories may be stored in the pattern of holes in the perineuronal net. Holes. First, you have no holes in the brain, right? No, there are synapses there. It's not holes, it's full. And then he had this impression that really this protein of the perineuronal net could form a code for memory. Well, you know, of course, we have the genetic code, and he wished to come with a new code, the code for memory. I think that he was wrong. I think that the PNN block plasticity, and we will all agree to that. Tien claimed that PNN proteins were very stable. It's possible. He had two or three postdocs in his laboratory, and using N15 diet, stable isotope, to compare the lifetimes of PNN proteins versus other proteins. And he had the impression that PNN proteins have a very long half-life. And then also what he did with the brain of people who were exposed to the nukes, the atomic bomb. We all had. And so the people of my age, we were exposed to the atomic bomb nukes, and our protein in the brain contains C14. And so he was trying to do that to show that the PNN of aged people like me contain PNN protein labeled with C14. I did not give my brain. So could we propose that the PV interneurons surrounded by PNN are engram cells, like the grandmother cell? But you know, the theory about grandmother cell is a little weak at the present time, and I don't think we could say that a single cell contains memory. It's really the complete system, the engram stable circuitry, will make that. And so, really, my belief at the present time is that really the PNN stabilize the PV interneurons and other neurons, because you see PNN are on other neurons, and then the system is fixed. And so the fact that you could remember stuff is maybe due to the PNN. So we are away from plasticity, of course. Then I want to show you this nice story about the hippocampus. As you know, hippocampus is not for long-term memory, but social memory is a long-term memory. And so social memory is associated with CA2. And see over here, CA2 is full of PNN, not only around the PV cell, but there. And so it's maybe the demonstration that, it's not the demonstration, but over here in CA1, you don't have any long-term memory, it's short-term memory. There you have an area of the hippocampus which is related to long-term memory, and there you have the PNN. So what next? I think what you need really is to get the precise structure of the PNN at nanometric resolution with new super resolution microscopy, and it's partly done already by you, Takao, and your associate. One question is that what really makes PNN different from ECM? What's the difference between the your protein from your joints to the one in the brain? So density, sugar code, specific protein, I really don't know. And so now my contribution is the presence of Adam TS in this PV cell. And what's the role of Adam TS there? It is for the formation, or for the modulation, or for the destruction? We don't know. So that's really a lot of questions for the next 10 years or century. I don't know. Thanks a lot.